Welcome to Relatable 2.0. This is your host, Teresa Freeman. I speak with Mike Kurtz of Mike's Hot Honey. He thought he was set after landing his dream job in the music business, yet somehow he found that he was not fulfilled. Cue the love of pizza and chili-infused honey. Enjoy my conversation with Mike. Excited to talk to you because I think one, as an entrepreneur, and then two, you know, having such a unique product and being able to talk a bit about that in your path, I feel like hopefully this podcast is, you know, people benefit from hearing other people's stories and how they've been able to navigate their path in their career and different pivot points along the way. Sometimes people date all the way back to when they were younger and things that happened, or, you know, more so from just kind of current day. So I just, I'd love to hear, maybe when you just started talking about being in the kitchen and sort of figuring out kind of this recipe. So maybe just start there and talk to me a little bit about that process, and then we can kind of maybe head backwards.
And sure. So actually the origin of the product goes back to, 2003. I was a college student studying Portuguese in Brazil, and on a weekend trip to a national park, I was hiking with some friends, and we hiked into this little valley. On the last day of our trip, we had been camping for like 4 or 5 days. We hiked into this little valley and found a pizzeria that had jars of whole chili peppers steeping in honey for drizzling on the pizza. And I've always loved pizza and loved spicy foods, and so the taste of the honey and the chili peppers on pizza really blew me away. And it was a flavor that I just kept on thinking about. And a year later, I got back to the States, and I was a senior in college at UMass in Amherst, where I grew up. And I kept on thinking about that experience and wanting to be able to selfishly consume that more on pizza at home. So I started tinkering with honey chili pepper infusions in my college apartment my senior year of college, and experimented with a range of different styles, techniques for infusing the flavor and heat of chili peppers into honey, different varietals of chili peppers, different varietals of honey, until I landed on the recipe that we still use today, albeit on a, you know, much smaller scale. So that was 2004. And the name Mike's Hot Honey has existed since 2004. So the recipe and the name are now 20 years old.
Wow.
But there was a long period after that, before it became, a packaged food product that was sold in stores. I got a call the day of my college graduation from UMass that I had gotten a job in New York City working for a record label, and they wanted me to start a few weeks later. So I literally got the call like as I was on my way to graduation with my cap and gown that I had a job. So that was exciting. I moved to New York a few weeks later and started a career in the music business back when people were still buying CDs, if some of our older listeners remember that. But all the while I was making the honey as a hobby, and we used to keep a bottle of it in the break room at the record label I worked, and everybody I worked with knew about it. They knew it was called Mike's Hot Honey. They had tasted it. We used to drizzle it on our lunch at work, but it was just that. It was really just a hobby for, 6-7 years. It all kind of changed in 2010. I had been making a lot of pizza at home.
Mm-hmm.
I had flour all over my kitchen. I had all sorts of baking supplies. I had attempted to tweak out my oven to try to get it to burn at a higher temperature. I was a pizza nerd, and I was always on this website, SliceBlog, which was the place online where people congregated to share information about pizza. Sadly, it doesn't exist anymore, but it was part of Serious Eats. And kept on seeing the same name pop up in the comments, the same handle, Paulie G, over and over again. He was commenting on every single article. And like, who is this guy? He's a serial commenter.
Role.
He's very active on the site.
Yeah.
And then finally they profiled him and they went to his backyard in New Jersey and showed off the wood-burning pizza oven that he had made. And they said he was going to be opening a pizzeria in Greenpoint, which was like the neighborhood over from where I lived at the time. So when he opened the pizzeria, I went there and I tried his pizzas and he came up to me and we were chatting and I started asking him questions about his dough recipe and his oven and how do you start the pizzeria and this and that. And you could tell I was really into making pizza. And he asked me if I wanted to come in as a pizza apprentice. So I
Good.
started going in after my day job, learning how to make pizza, learning how to make the dough, work the oven. I got to the point where I was fast enough that he started putting me on dinner shifts at the pizzeria. And one day I brought in a bottle of Mike's Hot Honey, which at the time was just sorry about that.
That's okay.
It was just a hobby, you know, but the name and the recipe existed, and brought a bottle in for Paulie to try, and he loved it, and he asked me if I could make it for the restaurant to use on the pizzas. So that was really,
Let me pause you there for one second, because there's like a couple of questions I have just in terms of the path part. So in terms of the, what was your degree in?
I studied, I was a triple major in Portuguese, African American studies, and ethnomusicology.
What was the last one?
Ethnomusicology, which is sort of a cultural study of music, kind of like a music history degree.
Okay. And then when you got the record label gig, was that at the time like your dream job? Is that what you at the time were like, oh my gosh, like, you know, you said you mentioned it was like on graduation day and you were stoked and it got to New York City, but was that at, you were like, this is kind of what I want to do?
Yeah, so my grandparents actually were in the music business. On my dad's side, they were both singers
Oh, cool.
in Philadelphia, and my dad's a jazz saxophonist, and I've always loved music, and it was a big part of my life. It's always been a big part of my life, and I thought I wanted to work in the music business, and I was like up until I got a taste of the music business and what the reality was. But yeah. Music's always been a big part of my life and my family. So, yeah, it was a dream job in a sense.
And how long were you there before you started, where you met up with Polly and you kind of started moonlighting in terms of?
6 years I was working. I worked for a record label. I started out in record sales. Then I worked in A&R, on the production of albums, and I shared an office with the lawyer who was doing all the licensing for the record label, and we shared an office for 3.5 years. So for 3.5 years, I listened to his contract negotiation on the phone, and I learned all the deal points of music licensing. And after that, I actually took a 1 year hiatus where I got a gig as a travel writer for the Boston Globe, doing a round the world trip, travel blogging for the Globe. So a friend of mine from high school, actually two friends from high school and I, we pitched this to the travel editor at the Globe in 2007. They sat on it for a year. Actually, they pitched it at the end of 2006, and they sat on it for like a year, came back and they said, hey, we want to run this thing. Only stipulation is you got to be in a new city every week for a year. So we were on the move for about a year, traveling the globe. 35 countries, 5 continents, blogging for the Boston Globe, for their travel website. Came back from that, started working independently as a music supervisor, doing licensing for television and film, working for a production company, kind of scraping together a living doing that, pretending I was a lawyer, even though I wasn't. I mean, I never pretend, I never technically said I was a lawyer, but I was doing work that usually is reserved for a lawyer just because I knew the deal points and I knew that it wasn't, for the most part, most of the contracts I was working on weren't really above my pay grade. So I was able to do that for a while. Eventually, I got a full-time job working as an assistant to a booking agent at an agency called ICM, which is a big booking agency.
So that whole time, because you that's so interesting, you just said a full-time job. So that whole time was not full-time work, or is it just like you're hired as, or is it when you left for a year, then you came back and had to sort of not start over, but find another gig, another real full-time job, so to speak?
Yeah, so the year that I left my full-time job at the record label was 2008. Of course, there was a big recession then, and so I came back at the end of that year to a vastly different economy, and I had to really piece of living together. And I was doing that as a music supervisor, and that I was working as an independent contractor, so I didn't have health insurance, and I was taking gigs, but it wasn't like full-time work. I mean, some weeks I would have a full workload, and other weeks it would be slower. And so I did that for about a year, and then I got this job at ICM as an assistant to a booking agent. And at this point, this is now like 6 years into the music business, and I'm thinking, I've invested 6 years, like I'm all in. It's too late to turn back now. And I think a lot of young people have that mindset that they've invested so much time, and in their mind, it's a lot of time. I think older people might tell them, like with a different perspective, might tell them, hey, it's really not too late. And I had this, when I met Polly and started working in the pizzeria, I was still working as an assistant to this booking agent during the day, and I was going to the pizzeria at night, and I saw how happy he was. He quit his day job at age 57. He was working in computer IT. He always says he masqueraded as a computer geek, even though he was really just a pizza guy all along. But he started making pizzas in his backyard, cobbled together some money from friends and family to open this pizzeria. And it was a hit. And after that, he says, he hasn't worked a day since because it doesn't feel like work to him. And so I was bearing witness to his career transformation really gave me the confidence to dive headfirst into the honey business, because at that point in my mind, before I had seen that, I was thinking, man, it's like, I'd love to jump into this, but it's too late. Like, I've invested so much time in the music business, even though it was only 6 years. In my young mind at that age, I was thinking, man, like, this is something I'm in too deep at this point to throw it all away. So it took me witnessing his sort of career move to give me the confidence to dive in. And then, the way the pizzeria was set up, the pizza oven was open to the floor of the restaurant. And so when I was making pizzas, I could see people's reactions to tasting the honey, and I could see how vivid their reactions were. And pretty soon people were coming up to me asking me, are you the honey guy, and where can we buy this stuff? And I wasn't selling it, so eventually enough people were asking that I started selling little Tupperware containers of the honey and little pints out of the restaurant for cash. And then eventually I got it together to John Ozarico, who was my best friend from kindergarten, who I moved to New York with, was a graphic designer, is still a graphic designer, and actually now a footwear designer. But at the time, he was just starting his career, and he designed the original label for our bottle, our first bottle. And I started selling bottles off the bar at the pizzeria in it was summer of 2010.
Okay. One question about the transition, and then I want to talk more about the honey. So when you were moonlighting, so this is the other thing that I think is so important for other people to hear, especially for people that are maybe exactly where you were 6 years in, or I really love talking with people that are actually on the sort of newer side of their career and maybe at a crossroads or right. And the idea of like you still working full time, but having the side hustle that was the thing you love to do, and then being able to figure out a way to then have that be your main gig, right? And so was that a conscious choice for you in terms of how you made that transition, in terms of you made that relationship with Polly, and then it was like he was giving you, you opened a window, but then for you to like kind of go through the window and then actually, kind of keep the main job, but then tell me just a little bit about your thought process there and then how you were able to, because I think that's an important piece that people sort of blow through, right? They see you now and they see how successful everything is now and they just think, oh, I'm sure it was always that way. So I'd like to hear a little bit about that transition part and the kind of work you had to put in order to get to that point where you could start selling it off the bar, you know?
Teresa's book, Soft Skills I Learned the Hard Way, is now available for purchase on our website at tfasoftskills.com or found on Amazon. She writes about epic fails throughout her career and how she learned from her mistakes so you don't have to. The book is full of cheat codes on how you can differentiate yourself when it matters, like in interviews, trying to get that promotion, or being a first-time leader. As always, thank you, Relatable Community.
Yeah, well, there's a few things. I mean, New York City is an expensive place to live, but I had three other roommates at the time, so my rent was pretty low.
Okay.
Had a good deal on a house that today I think would be a lot more expensive. So I had the luxury of paying a very low cost of living in New York at the time. So that gave me the flexibility. And, I didn't start paying myself a salary from the business. I wasn't drawing a salary until maybe a year, maybe like 3.5 years in. So, it started out, I was working at the pizzeria at night. I had my day job. I was selling honey off the bar. And then, the pizzeria got busier and busier and the honey sales ticked up and up. And eventually I realized, hey, I can pay my rent with the money I'm making working as a pizza guy, and the money I make from selling honey bottles, I'm going to reinvest into the business and try to grow that. And this other career working as an assistant to a booking agent, I mean, it was like, if anybody has seen Entourage, I was like Lloyd from Entourage. It was the agent I worked for was not abusive in the same way Ari was to Lloyd on that show. But it is that type of environment where it's a bit of a toxic environment. And I kind of saw that and realized, hey, like the trajectory here is you work 5, 6 years an assistant to a booking agent, and eventually the agent starts giving you scraps off of their roster of artists, and you take the artists that they don't want anymore, and you start building your name as an agent. But it takes 5 or 6 years before most people make that transition. So I was looking at that and saying, man, like, I don't like being here. It doesn't bring me joy, and I can't imagine spending that much time like trying to build my name in this business. And I was loving life at the pizzeria. It made me happy to make pizza. I was completely different, but there's something about stretching dough and making great pizza and bringing joy to people and being able to watch them enjoy something that you made with your hands. That was really fulfilling.
Yeah.
And I said, look, like, I pay my rent, I'm not gonna lose my home. Like, why don't I try this out? So I walked into the office of the agent that I was working for one day, and I just told him, I was like, that honey I've been working on? And he said, yeah. And I said, the pizzeria I've been moonlighting on? He said, yeah. Like, I'm gonna do that full time now. And he's like, you've gotta be kidding me. You know how many people would kill for your job, like would kill for this opportunity to be here? And I know it was hard to get that job, like a very competitive landscape. And there are a lot of people that want that opportunity. And I just said, that's fine. It's just not for me. I found something else that I think is my calling, and I'm going to go for it. And I walked out the door, and it was the best feeling. It was the best feeling in the world when I walked out that day. I just felt so free, and I felt like a huge weight had been lifted. And, I felt like I was going to invest in myself, which was a great
And then
thing.
did you just never look back, like in terms of, once you made that, because I'm sure that just deciding that and that going back and forth to your point around putting so much time and investing all that into that career. And I think too, the exactly how you described it, not just the guy you worked for, but I think a lot of people kind of outside looking in would be like, are you crazy? Because there's a, I think maybe a stigma to like the restaurant life or being a chef or being part of that world. Like you could never be as successful as you could be in the music industry, right? So like I'm, you know, so I'm sure like you making that choice, you're kind of like going against the grain and also you know, in a way, like you're sort of risking, right? You don't really know what's going to happen. And the fact that like you felt, I think I love what you described about like kind of that inner feeling of happiness and feeling like the creativity and being a part of that. And it was like maybe the things you thought you would get in the music industry, but it wasn't responding to you there. But yet in the pizza world, right, you were getting all that fulfillment.
Yeah, and you know, I think part of the reason I was able to jump into it was because I had already, you know, I had been seeing at that point for a few weeks the reactions to people tasting the product. So I was like, all
Yeah.
right, it's not just my friends and family
It
who are
yeah.
having these reactions. These are random strangers, and this thing really has legs. So that's like a, I think, a valuable lesson for anybody who's an entrepreneur. Like, finding a testing ground for your product or your idea is so powerful because it allows you to really like test your assumptions about something and get really valuable feedback and knowledge, and then you just iterate from there. So I had this built-in testing ground in the pizzeria.
But don't you think, not but, I should say and, there's a couple of things to that. One, you had put in the time to build the relationship with Polly. You had put in the time to be an apprentice. It's not like you came in and were like, sell my honey, right? To me, there's like a relationship aspect to this as well, that you're building trust, right? And that, or maybe the product just stands on its own. I don't know, maybe it's an integration of those two things. But the idea that like, because I think the fact that you made the product so early on and that was such like a part of you and your own creativity and all the different things that you tried, it almost seems like that came first beyond just being an entrepreneur and trying to sell something. Because I think that is a piece of it too, is being connected to what you're selling.
Yeah, it's true. I think like to that point, I mean, I was a pizza nerd, and
I
Polly
love
was a pizza nerd, is a
that.
pizza nerd. We still are. And we sort of were part of this community of pizza nerds, and some of them own restaurants and some of them are just at home pizza makers, but we're really part of that community. And the product was really born out of that community. And I think that's part of the reason why it was really widely embraced by pizzerias. I mean, part of it is that other pizzerias saw the success that Polly had with the product and wanted a piece of that success. But part of it was that they saw me as one of their own, you know, because I was working in a pizzeria and I came out of a pizzeria. So it was a product that I think a lot of pizzerias felt proud to use because of that. So yeah, I mean, pizza nerds unite.
How complicated is it to make it?
It's more complicated than meets the eye. I know it's you know, there are no ingredients that you don't recognize on the label, but it took a long time to scale up production.
Yeah.
It was really, really hard. I mean, that was probably the biggest inflection point in the business to date was. There've been a lot of milestones, so I don't say that lightly. But taking it from something that I made by hand in a kitchen to something that was made on an industrial production line was extremely difficult. And I think for many, many food manufacturers or CPG products, that is often like the biggest hurdle is finding a way to scale up, because it's sort of this chicken and the egg thing. It's like, a large scale manufacturer is going to require you to hit a certain minimum, but you can't get to that minimum until you have large scale manufacturing. So it's like you can't, it's so hard to get to the point where you're doing enough business that you can afford to do a run with a co-packer or a big manufacturer. And it's hard to get a big manufacturer to just give you the time of day when you're, you know, a tiny one person business. And I struck out over and over again because I was like, this was year, started the business in 2010. I didn't scale production until 2014. And I personally bottled every single bottle between 2010 and 2014. So it was tens of
Wow.
thousands of bottles by hand. I used to write the label, the batch number on the label. And I kept on striking out with honey packers who was looking for help packing my product because it wasn't worth the risk to them to take a chili pepper infused honey and run it on a pure honey line. I knew I needed somebody who handled honey because the product required honey specific equipment. And I kept on finding these honey packers, and all of them said the same thing. This just isn't worth the risk. If we clean our line after a production run and there's still some residual chili pepper, it could ruin an entire batch of pure honey. And honey, as you know, is a very valuable commodity. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
So I just couldn't find anybody. And eventually, one of the suppliers I was working with said, "Hey, there's this guy, Grant Stiles, and, he's a beekeeper from upstate New York, and give it a shot." And so I went to meet Grant, and he had hives in upstate New York and a little production line in New Jersey, about 20 minutes south of Newark. So I went over to his production line, and he warned me before I got there. He was like, I just want to let you know when you arrive here, don't be alarmed. It's not going to look like much. He's like, I don't know what you have in mind, but it's not one of these stainless steel factories. So
Yeah.
I get there and I'm like, I'm looking around, I'm like, where's the production facility? And he's like, it's in my garage. So I go into the garage and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Like, this is,
What,
there's no
amateur
way
hour?
this is going to work. And he said to me, he's like, listen, I know it doesn't look like much, but I assure you we can do big volume out of this space. And a few years later, he and his team filled an order for 4,000 Walmart stores 2 weeks early in that same garage. So
Holy, you know what? Not that we can't cuss on here, but wow. So what? Okay. Oh my gosh, so many questions. In terms of getting rejected for 4 years straight,
yeah.
what was it that kept you going and trying? You just
Well, I knew that people wanted the product.
Yeah.
There was a real demand for it. I mean, I was exposed in the press very early on. I had like, let's see, I had Esquire magazine featured me in print in their like best of the year issue, Savoir magazine. There's a fair amount of press that came early on because the product was so novel. Also, I was doing this in New York, and benefit of starting a company in New York at the doorstep of every major media outlet is that you're surrounded by journalists. Like, these are the people that are eating in the pizzeria where I was working. I
Right.
felt like this was their product to share with the world. So I got really overexposed in the press when I was still a one-man operation and wasn't able to scale up production. So there was a real demand. I had a lot of retailers asking for it, restaurants asking for it, and that's what kept me going. I mean, I was like, I gotta do this because there's a real opportunity here.
Did you ever at bring, I'm assuming now, I mean, we'll get to now, but at that time, like when you met Grant, and then how many, like when did you start acquiring employees, or when have you ever had someone kind of now become a partner with you? Is Grant your partner? Tell me a little bit about going from like a party of one to sort of what that next step was like.
Yeah, so Grant started production in 2014, which was the same year I landed at Whole Foods, our first supermarket to carry the product. It was Whole Foods 3rd and 3rd in Gowanus, which was their first store in New York City. And at the time, I think they had like 10 or so stores. And this is, yeah, obviously it was before Amazon was involved with Whole Foods, but it was a little bit more, it was easier to like get into a single store one at a time and do it piecemeal. I think that's harder to do now. But once we were in the system, I started showing up to the other Whole Foods in the city with two cases of product. And I would go find the honey buyer and say, hey, scan this barcode You'll see this product is in your system. It's approved for sale. If you carve out one bottle wide on the shelf for me, I'll pack these two cases out on the shelf, and you're gonna get, two cases of free product. That's free revenue for your set. And it was a good deal for them. It was a good deal for me and good deal for them. And that's how I got my foot in the door. And I was doing like demos myself in all the Whole Foods stores. And eventually I did that one by one and got into all the Whole Foods stores in the city. I had a bunch of independent specialty stores, cheese shops around the country I was shipping to. I was doing direct mail order online. But I got to a point where I really needed help. I needed help with accounting. I needed help with financial planning. I was really like just shooting from the hip, and had no experience with business besides the music business, and but no formal experience. And I had a serendipitous reconnection with my business partner Matt, who was a friend of mine from freshman year of college, University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I went my freshman year of college. My mom went to school there, so I had a connection there. And Matt's from Wisconsin, so we were both freshmen in the same dorm there. And his wife was starting a PhD in business at UMass Boston. They were moving to Boston, so he reached out to me because he knew I was from Massachusetts, and we reconnected. And they came down to New York one day, and I had dinner with them, and I took them to Pauly G's, and they experienced the pizza and the honey, and I filled them in on what I was doing. And like a week later, he hit me up and he was like, "Hey, like, I'm looking to get out of my corporate job and into a startup, and I think you really have something here, and I think I can really help you." And he really possessed the skill set that complemented mine. Matt, my business partner, Matt Beaton, had an MBA from Kellogg at Northwestern, had worked at Wrigley, so had some CPG
Like,
experience working at
yeah.
Wrigley. He met his wife Erin at Wrigley, so it was kind of a two for one deal. Erin's smarter than both of us, so it was, I was getting a two for one deal on
Yeah.
them. And so we worked out a partnership agreement, which took a while because the brand was already, I had
Sure.
already been on national television, I had been in a lot of press, I was already in Whole Foods, I had scaled up production, which took a long time. It was 5 years of work at that point. So it's hard to bring in a business partner midway through. It's a lot different than when you're just starting something clean from the beginning. But
Yeah.
we were able to work out a partnership agreement that was fair to both of us. And he came on board and we started growing the business together. And we started working with distributors and grooming the business to take on an investment. And as we were looking for investors, I actually thought it was going to be easier than it was. I don't mean to sound cocky, but I thought like, hey, we've got all this great press.
Yeah.
It's a novel product. People lo love it. Never goes bad. Like, what else do
Yeah.
you want?
Yeah.
But it was really hard in the beginning. We struck out a lot. But in 2017, one of our now investors was at a board meeting for a pizzeria they had invested in, and saw a bottle of our honey on the table at the board meeting and asked, "What's this?" and found out we were looking to take on investors. And we had a meeting with them, and they gave us our first investment in the company, and I think we raised $2 million in our initial raise. In 2017.
And let me ask, just in terms of like, for those of us that are like maybe don't fully understand, in terms of that investor, like seeking that investor support, that is to fund business operations, I suspect. It's to fund like you expanding your business operations and trying to get even more distribution, whether it's like domestic or international. Like, tell me a little bit about what that investment is for. Like, is it to bring people on? What is it that you're seeking through that?
Yeah, I think the key thing with taking on investors is in an investment in your company is that You want to know how you're going to spend every dollar that you take. Otherwise, you're just diluting yourself for money that you're not going to spend or you don't have a plan to spend. So you better have a plan for how you're going to spend it and how it's going to grow your company. And you get comfortable with this idea that your piece of the pie is going to get smaller, but the pie itself is going to get a whole lot bigger.
Relatable is sponsored by TFA Soft Skills, your one-stop shop for workshops, coaching, speaking, and soft skills development. If you'd like to hire Teresa or any members of her team, please visit www.tfasoftskills.com for more information.
So once you wrap your head around that and get comfortable with it and have a plan for how you're going to grow the business, then it becomes clear. And so it, you know, it, we needed capital to fill new orders. You know, we were starting to get inquiries from bigger retailers. So we needed more capital to just be able to produce those orders and hold larger amounts of inventory. And we needed bodies to help us do things. I mean, we were two people. So
yeah.
But you know, we got, I think, you know, it's a mix of skill and luck. You know, there's definitely luck involved in business, but we were very fortunate to hire some great people early on that really helped us create an awesome foundation for the business. And then, you know, the more great people you have in your organization, you know, that sort of creates a culture, and then you start to bring in more like-minded people. And we were really lucky in the beginning. One of our he's actually our first employee, Kent Spellman. He came to the meeting with our investors. He was a friend. He was retired, and he was a friend of the, you know, our initial investor. And he came to the meeting, our first meeting. And I think in his mind, he's told me that he thought it was a dumb idea, and he was just doing it as a favor to his friend. And after the meeting with us, he said, "I want to invest in the company, but I also would like to work for you guys full time, and I'll do anything. I'll take out the trash. Like, I don't care. Just put me to work." And
wow.
He's now the president of Mike's Out Honey and has worn every hat under the sun and is one of these people that is just, you know, really sharp and able to figure anything out. You know, you give him any problem, he can solve it. And
what do you think made him do that? Like, just after meeting with you, was it, what do you think changed his mind?
Well, the guy loves food. So I think he saw something that was new, novel, exciting in the food space, and you know, opportunity to get in at the ground level of that. And I think that was exciting for him. And I think, you know, we just had a good rapport right off the bat, and we got along well. And you know, it was obvious to me that he was, you know, right from the get-go, that he was going to be a great partner in the business and person to work with. So yeah, we just hit it off, and the three of us started working together. I think our first hire after that was a retail salesperson, an ops person. And, you know, we were five, and then, you know, and then we were six, and we started slowly growing the team. But again, like, a lot of these hires came from people, from connections of our existing staff. And
yeah,
we also, you know, this is before the pandemic, we realized pretty early on that we weren't going to be able to compete on salary with some of these bigger CPG companies. And so if we were going to recruit the best talent, we needed to offer maximum flexibility. And so, like, we were able to hire our head of retail sales because she had three kids and two dogs and a husband and didn't want to commute to work and wanted to spend more time with her family. And we said, "Hey, like, we can offer you all that flexibility. Like, your salary is not going to be quite as high as what you might get, you know, at you know, a big CPG company, but your quality of life is going to be better." And that really matters to a lot of people. So, and I think now it's almost become table stakes for a lot of companies that you're trying to hire the best talent. You got to offer flexibility, let people work remotely, and you're going to have a hard time hiring great people if you don't offer that.
Is CPG, consumer product something?
Consumer product goods.
Goods. Okay. Okay. And then
Yeah.
how many people do you all have now?
Think we're at 28 people full time.
And how does it feel like where you are now in terms of it's almost, your household name, I would say, or getting there. Like how, when you think about the journey to this point and kind of where you are with everything, how does it feel to you now?
I mean, I'm just so incredibly grateful for the people I get to work with every day and how smart and talented and thoughtful they are. Like, I have the best team and we're having a good time building this thing together. And everybody has their moments and we have heated arguments about things, but like, we just have great people. And I think that was kind of like our strategy was, nobody's worked in the hot honey business, and it's not rocket science. Like it's we're selling a condiment, we're selling a chili pepper infused honey, and anybody can do that. And it's really about hiring really smart, talented, thoughtful, like-minded people,
Yeah.
and then giving them the tools to succeed. So like I mean, I gotta pinch myself sometimes where like it's funny because we go through so many, there we have so many things going on that sometimes you forget to stop to like celebrate the wins.
Yeah,
Like
that's I was, yeah.
we're in 9,000 plus Dunkin's on the menu, three branded menu items. And it doesn't get much bigger than that in food service.
Yeah.
So
Well, and I went to, I'm so glad you said that because I meant to ask you about the Whole Foods, right? When you said when you first got in, like, I think that's like people always, you hear like celebrities that are interviews, like, what'd you do with your first big check, right? But for you, like, that first big moment of like being in that kind of store that's like well known and you kind of feel like it's like, oh my gosh, this is like tripping. Were you able to celebrate that? Like, are you able to kind of take that in, or is it like you're just in that mode of like trying to grow it? Or you said you there have been so many milestones. So, like, have you been able to celebrate those, or what are some of the ones that you think of the most?
I mean, the ones early on are probably the
Yeah.
most memorable ones. Like we were in the New York Times holiday gift guide, and I was still a one man operation. It was on the homepage of the New York Times for like 3 weeks, linking to my website. The amount of traffic that that drove, and the amount of orders that were coming through, I was like a machine packing boxes that holiday season, just shipping and receiving, and. So that was a real grind, but like an incredible rush. I still remember my first PO from Williams Sonoma, which was like the first like big chain that we worked with, and we were nationwide in Williams Sonoma, and I was still a one man operation. And I remember getting the PO and being like, holy crap, like this is like, I forget, I don't even remember what the number was. I forget, it's like $25,000 or something like that, and I just like, I
Yeah.
couldn't believe it. But you get bigger and bigger, and it's like now we have a team that we kind of all celebrate each other's wins, and
Yeah.
sometimes it's like it'll be a win on the ops team, like the ops team unlocks some new efficiency that makes our margin better. That's a win that you celebrate because you understand how impactful those things can be. And or like it'll be like little details like, we got this food service collaboration with this chain, but they're actually showing our retail bottle on the menu as opposed to just buying the product. And how big of a impact that
Oh,
can have
I,
for retail. And
yeah.
like so it's It, you start to like understand the business more and really understand like the truly impactful things that grow a brand. And what's interesting about supermarket products, it's like you compare us to like growing a clothing brand. Well, how many clothing stores are there out there compared to supermarkets? Not as many. There's just
Right.
not as many points of distribution for clothes as there are for supermarkets. Supermarkets, you get your product on the shelf in a supermarket. I mean, people will know your brand eventually because everybody has to eat and everybody
Right.
is shopping for, in the grocery store all over the country. And that's a lot of points of distribution. So just being on shelf really helps grow a brand. It's a lot harder to do that in other industries where there just are fewer points of sale.
Yeah. Do you still, okay, two other, do you still keep in touch with Grant? Like, where is he in this whole scenario? Did he gra move along with you? Did, you know, how did that, where is he now with distribution?
Yeah, so he's still one of our primary suppliers.
Really? And it's
Still
his
work with
honey
him.
that you like, because he has
Yeah,
been,
some of
right?
it is his honey. He was able to build a new production facility down the street from the original garage. Stainless steel, spotless, like beautiful production
Yeah.
facility, and that's still today. They're one of our primary production partners in
I
the business.
love that. And then Polly, what's going on there? Do you ever like, are you ever like, do you still check in there? I mean, obviously it seems like you're still friends, but like, I'm
Yeah.
guessing you're still not slinging pizzas anywhere.
I'm not working there anymore, but I did work there for a while. I worked making pizzas, and then after that, when I stopped making pizzas, I would still work Monday nights as the floor manager at the restaurant, and I no longer do that, but Paulie is his pizzeria is around the corner from our office. He's still one of the biggest ambassadors for the brand. He's expanded quite a bit. He's opened pizzerias in a bunch of different cities. All of them are partners of ours. So, that whole family of restaurants, they still to this day, big partner of ours. And he lives around the corner from our office in the restaurant. So
Yeah.
we still see each other quite a bit.
Do you feel like as that, you know, kind of the person that was so connected to it in terms of creating the recipe and then you being kind of a one man business for so long and kind of pushing for so long, how does it feel to then, you know, to get bigger and you're, you know, obviously you're sharing that experience now with a lot more people and you're probably removed from certain aspects of it that you were, you know, closely aligned to early on. Like, how has that maturation been? Like, is that hard sometimes? Do you miss any parts of sort of the early days, or is it all just gravy now, given like, you know, the everything you've kind of been through?
I mean, in some ways, when you're a one person operation and you can unilaterally make decisions, it can be easier. But the flip side of that is you have nobody to bounce ideas off of, or debate things with. And I can tell you from experience, it's a whole lot more fun to do something with a team of people than to do it on your own. And so yeah, I don't miss those days. They were fun while they lasted, and I'm grateful for that experience and I learned a lot. But it was just such a grueling, it was a grueling era of, I mean, people will tell you my hands are softer than they used to be because I'm not working the production line anymore. I'm doing this instead of actually like packing boxes. But like I'm grateful that I had the experience of doing all the kind of working all the different parts of the business, because I learned a lot, but yeah, having an awesome team of people to work with makes it a lot more fun. And I think people can tell that our brand is having a good time. I think people can tell that our staff is having a good time. Like, you can feel it when you're around our team, and it's cool to see. It's cool to build a company and see like the relationships that come out of that. People become friends, or people who are part of our team become friends with our restaurant partners who are also sort of part of our family. And you see those relationships develop over years, and it's just like that's really gratifying to just see like the real relationships that come out of it.
And I feel like it's like juxtaposed to the whole music industry. It, like everything you're describing around like the familial nature of what you've built, it just seems like you've said it a number of times in terms of how much you love your team and how much you love being together, and you hired people that you knew would like fit well, like bright and like sort of like-minded and fit, right? And like there's just this like energy about it. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not as intimately familiar as you are, certainly, with that kind of industry, but it just seems like it's such a different industry that you're in now. And what you've created for yourself is not that you can't have friends and family and anywhere that you work, but it just strikes me, right, as you're talking about it, that it's sort of this, not only was it sort of a different path in terms of like you took a risk on yourself and you took a risk on something totally different, but the outcome also, you know, seems like it's just super fulfilling.
Yeah, I guess the food business is more down to earth than the music business.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
Food's pretty, it's a pretty down to earth sector of business.
Interesting. Yeah.
And the music business is wonderful in many ways, and I love music, but I don't miss it as a livelihood. You know,
Yeah.
it'll always be a part of my life, but I'm grateful that it's not what I rely on to pay the bills, and that it can just be a hobby and something I
Yeah.
enjoy. Food is I think, both of those things are universal, food and music.
Yeah.
Food being even, I would say, even more universal in a way. It's just like such an easy way to connect with people,
Yeah.
and the people I've met along the way and the places I've been to where I would have had no business like being in any of these places or meeting these people. But, because of this one product, I was able to connect with all these different people all over the country and around the world, and truly changed my life.
Yeah, that's incredible. Let me ask you, okay, two more questions. One is around soft skills because that's my business. And I'm trying to have a little like mini crusade around the importance of what I think soft skills bring to the table, and that we're sort of a culture and a people that are like missing out on that to some extent because of tech and other things. And so I'm curious for you, as you've evolved this business, and particularly maybe even in the early stages, like, and when I say soft skills, you know, I'm talking about like collaboration and influence and communication and kind of more the people side of things. What are the one or two skills in that area that you feel have best served you to help make this business a success?
I think when it comes to like what we're doing, we're building a brand. Ultimately our goal is we don't I'm we're not trying to like keep this business in the family forever. We want to grow the company and eventually sell it to a bigger company. But so we know that the bigger companies who would acquire us are We know that they could manufacture a product, they could flip a switch and put a product into thousands of stores overnight. What they can't do is build a brand.
If you'd like to advertise with Relatable, please email us at info@tfasoftskills.com. Now back to the show.
And so the value that we bring to the table is our brand. And so we're building a brand, and I think one of the key things that we've like leaned into in building the brand is forging genuine connections with people. And that goes a long way. And I think like sometimes you have to slow down a little bit to forge those connections. But I think, people move really fast. The world's moving really fast. It feels like it's moving faster than ever before. So many connections are made online, in the digital space. We invest probably more time than maybe other brands in our space in like in-person events, trying to meet people in person, connect with them in person, especially on like with our restaurant partners. We try to spend time with people and forge genuine connections, and I think that goes a really, really long way in terms of building a brand. And so like just taking the time to slow down, meet people, listen, really forge a genuine relationship, I think is can be can be powerful in some ways is like undervalued in today's landscape.
Totally. And if you listen back to your story, just in terms of our conversation, it was built on relationships, right? And I mean, in terms of like Polly kind of seeing your comments in the right, and then you connecting with him, and then your friendship from your freshman year in college, and then hiring people, like, just I find like it's such a powerful thing. And I agree with you, like, it's underestimated and we're not sort of talking about it enough, but that idea of personal connection, and then keeping, and then watering those, watering and feeding those connections and staying connected. So it's to your point around their partners and people that you work with. It's not just like, here's the product, see you later. It's like, no, we're still connected and we still have a relationship with you that's just beyond that, the service of the product. And I think to your point around the brand piece, absolutely. Like you said, I think, like you said, that people kind of feel that energy or feel that you all are having a good time, and that there's, I believe that, like, energetically, there's people feel that vibe, and then they want the product, even if it's, just that part of it. Like, I want to be part of something that feels like that, All right, and then the last one is just advice to your younger self. So you've had like this very interesting path and kind of a big pivot from one business to another. I feel like we could spend a whole nother hour on your trip around the globe. Maybe we'll talk again, because that seems like that would be a really cool experience to talk about. But if you were going to kind of put your arm around someone in their 20s at this point and give them some advice, or advice to your younger self, what would you say to them?
Well, it took me like living the experience to learn this lesson, but I would say this to like my younger self or younger people in general, that it's really never too late to switch gears in your professional life or your personal life for that matter. Like, I think there's this idea that you grow up with that like you're supposed to pick a career path and you study it in college and you work it and that's just what you do for the rest of your life, and that you invest 10, 15 years in something, you can't switch gears to something new. And that's just not true. I think there's definitely this facade that like, makes it seem like it's really difficult to transition into a new career, but so many skills are transferable. And like most people are faking it till they make it. And so like it's, I think, there's obviously careers that, take a very acute skill set, but I think there are just so many others where you can easily take something you've been doing and apply it to something new. And so I would just remind myself and other people that it's really never too late to pursue something new.
Mike, I love that so much. And I feel like you've done such a great job, I think, in this conversation of explaining that and in real detail about like how you, the choices you made, and how you changed it. And I agree that it is a facade, particularly when you work at places that want you to think it's the only option. So the
Right.
whole like golden handcuffs thing, or you drink the Kool-Aid, and I was in professional services world forever. And I was such a product of that environment that it felt like this is the only way to make good money, the only way to have flexibility, whatever those things are. And then they sort of trick you into thinking, and your own willingness to believe it. So to your point around, like, there are a lot of transferable skills. There's a lot of ways to be happy. There's a lot of ways that you can engage in the world. And so, kind of be open to that, especially if you're feeling stuck. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you and get to know you, and I'm so appreciative of the time. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Teresa. I really appreciate it. It's been nice chatting with you.
Been great. And my husband is a total foodie and loves to cook, and he's so excited to like practice. Thank you so much for sending us some of your products. And so he's super excited, and he's going to love this conversation because he has a whole passion around food. And also, it's so funny you mentioned the thing about tweaking your oven. He's so frustrated that he can't get the oven hot enough to make the perfect pizza. It just drives him insane. So he's gonna love that part of this conversation.
It's an endless quest for perfection in the pizza nerd world. Sometimes you just gotta make the pizza that works the best in your oven, not the pizza that you necessarily want to make.
Okay. I'll have to share that. I'll pass that on to him. Thank you again. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Hope you enjoyed my conversation with Mike. As a reminder, please rate, subscribe, and leave comments. Until next time, this is Career Coach T. Stay connected.